2008, and I'm Bob Dobbs, representing the Garrett Dean Poets Society of Halifax, Nova Scotia. And we have a friend of Garrett's from way back, Mr. Paris Flamand, who's in Pennsylvania, right?
Yes, that is correct.
And first, to get us going, I'm going to bring in a synchronicity note. I was, and still am, Marshall McLuhan's archivist, Paris.
I'm sorry, you are which archivist?
Marshall McLuhan.
Oh, yes, really, I didn't know that.
Right, now...
Of course, I remembered that he was Canadian, of course.
Right, and I think it was Eric Norden, your friend, who did the Playboy interview with Marshall McLuhan.
Yes, undoubtedly. Eric did, I don't, can't remember now, perhaps 17 or 18 interviews, including the legendary one with Jim Garrison.
Yes.
He did Albert Speer. He went to Berlin to do Albert Speer. He did an amazing number of interviews, yes, and I'm certain that he did Mr. McLuhan as well.
Yeah, well, I know he did. He's registered as being the one who did it, and I was wondering if Mr. Norden ever mentioned his interview with McLuhan to you.
Yes, well, over the years, Eric at one time was probably... one of my three closest associates. I was the person who put him on radio originally and sort of got his career started. And from that, of course, he evolved into the interviewer for Playboy, et cetera, et cetera. And we discussed a number of the people he interviewed, inevitably, because they were, for the most part, the most interesting people abroad at the time.
Yes.
And among those was McLuhan, Albert Speer, and Truman Capote, and so on and so forth.
Did he do Jim Garrison?
Pardon me?
Did he interview Jim Garrison for Playboy?
No, Eric did.
No, I meant, that's what I meant. Did Eric interview Jim Garrison?
Oh, yes, lately. As a matter of fact, it is probably the most plagiarized piece of material done in the last 40 years. It's endlessly quoted, but almost never attributed. I was working with Jim, had just begun to work with Jim on some aspects of his case having to do with the old Catholic Church, having to do with Permandex and the Centro Mondiale Comercial in Europe, and things like that. And Eric followed up on that by suggesting to Playboy that an interview with this... now becoming more and more controversial, New Orleans district attorney might be appropriate. They grabbed the idea immediately, and he and I flew down to New Orleans together that spring. And while I was working with Jim on, I suppose you would call it a consultant level, he was working with him on an interview level, and the interview came out a couple of months later.
Yes, I remember reading at the time. It was October of 67, and so I guess you're talking you went down the spring of 67.
Yes, right.
Yeah, now, I remember, what I remember is that Marshall McLuhan, he gave answers, I guess it was auditory, I'm not sure, because I heard that Eric couldn't really understand Marshall, what he was saying or what he was doing, or communicating, whatever medium, and in
you
the
mean
end,
because of his Canadian vowels.
Yeah, no, just the language. So it must have been written, because in the end, the story is that McLuhan had to write out the answers himself, rather than.
I don't know. I've never known. I never knew. I can say no, although he doesn't do it anymore. Of course, he's still with us on this plane. But I never knew him not to do an interview vis-a-vis. I never heard of him doing and there are occasions where other people do written interviews, that is, they send the questions and the interviewee writes the answers, but I never knew of Eric functioning that way. That is not to say that he might not have on some occasions, but I just never knew of it in any of the dozen and a half interviews I knew him to do.
Right. I guess what the general impression is that he couldn't understand Marshall, or he didn't know how to write it down, or the answers were too long, so he asked McLuhan to write it. So the thing is that, could you get me in touch with Eric? I mean, as McLuhan's archivist, that might be interesting to interview him about that interview.
You mean Eric himself?
Yeah, he's still alive, you're saying?
Oh, yes. He lived for many, many years in from childhood to just so about 7-8 years ago in a rather posh area of Brooklyn, New York. Most people don't who do not live in New York don't realize that there is a posh area to Brooklyn. But nonetheless, he moved further out in Long Island and so far away that I haven't seen him. I spoke to him on the phone about 4 months ago, but I haven't hadn't spoken to him prior to that for, oh, a good decade and a half, and I haven't seen him for longer than that. So I would suspect he might be disinclined to subject himself to an interview. He's become rather isolated in his work and almost exclusively communicates with by mail, as far as that's my understanding, although, as I say, I've not been, well, actually, I was going to say intimate, but I actually haven't really seen him at all for at least a decade and a half.
Okay, so let's see. So that's our preamble is about Eric Norden. Now we're going to go to Garrett. You saw the pictures I sent to you, the close-ups of his face. You thought they were pretty fine representations.
I thought they were extremely good, yes. I gather it's the same picture printed and reprinted reprinted three times. There are four prints you sent, and they seem to be virtually identical. So I assume it's the same photograph?
Yes. What happened is that in Halifax, the person who organized the Garrett Dean Society and a longtime friend of Garrett's, Giovanna
mm-hmm.
Roach, I'm moving to Maui, the Hawaiian Islands,
mm-hmm, yes.
With my wife on the 1st of June, and she wanted me to have a present from Garrett. So she had this photo from the funeral, well, was given out at the funeral back in 93 and was enlarged. So it's
mm-hmm.
like, I don't know, like 2 by 3 feet
uh-huh.
into a wooden kind of thing. And
let me understand so I know exactly from whence you're coming. You say you are moving to the islands?
Yeah, I'm moving to Maui the 1st of June.
Oh, well, permanently?
Yes.
Oh, well, how enviable. Beautiful down there.
Yes, I'm going to heaven.
I haven't been there for 30 years, but I did love the islands, especially Grenada. But envy is not one of my faults, but if it were, I would envy you.
Yes. Now, so the thing is that Giovanna wanted to give me a token of Garrett, so she gave me this wooden production of a photo, but
mm-hmm.
the wooden production, framing, whatever, is 3 by 2, and so Sue Bone, another member of the Garrett Dean Society, took photos, different angles or different close-ups of the framed image. That's what you're seeing. Yes. Now, did Garrett look like that to you in 65, which is about the time you think you last saw him?
No, he looked... what year would this have been these have been taken?
The late 80s.
Yes, I know. He certainly looked a great deal older. He was still... when I knew him, he was still somewhat Oscar-wielding... romantic 19th century image of a poet sort of thing, and he also affected the dress of that period to a great extent. I know that at that period he was fond of green waistcoats under whatever other attire he was wearing. I wanted to ask you, do you have I don't know if I can take the picture that you have sent off, but my wife happened to be come in the my office and glanced down and saw his face and found him an extremely interesting man. She is a professional painter, especially a portraitist, and I'm going to try to get a color print off the computer screen for her to do a portrait of that, but if you'd would be interested, make sure you send me your mom address, and I'll send you a little photo of the portrait when it gets completed.
Oh, that's fantastic. Excellent. I encourage that. That's going to be great.
Yeah, good, because she's an extremely likeness-oriented composer. She, one of her problems with customers and clients is that she is will not deign to make them prettier than they are. But Garrett has such a strong, interesting face, it will serve its own purpose.
That's right. Now, Sue Bone, in the late 80s, took about 8 pictures of Garrett in his kitchen, sort of in different facial poses.
Yes, uh-huh.
And she's going to send them to me in a week or so, and I'll send them to you. Your wife may find those interesting faces, too.
Ah, very good. She'd be delighted to see them. She's always looking for something. Unfortunately, we live in a rather provincial area now, and there are simply not too many interesting people about, either intellectually or physiognomically. But so she would be delighted to get them, I'm sure.
Great. That is her name, Marcia?
Yes, with a C, M-A-R-C-I-A.
Yes, she's the one who sent an email a month or so ago.
Mm-hmm.
So did she meet Garrett?
No. I met Marcia about, the last time I saw Garrett can't have been... Well, no, I suppose I did see him perhaps a time or two after I met her, but I didn't meet her until about 63.
Right.
And, there was a long, I think I mentioned earlier on, there was a very lengthy hiatus between the time you contacted me and the last time I saw him.
Yeah.
Well, of course, I moved out of New York in 71. So, I really, really went back. You mentioned something about the demise of the village in your last communication, and I left New York for 2 reasons, one of which my health, my wife had been warned, was extremely precarious, and the other was that the village was dead, and I had no interest in living in New York proper, but we came out to the country because I was able to get a rather nice home out here.
Right, so that was when the counterculture was taking over the village. I don't think Garrett liked the counterculture too much. You would agree with him?
Well, a great deal happened. First place, the racial makeup of the village changed enormously in just a matter of a couple of months.
Really?
And therefore the cultural makeup of it changed as a consequence of that. The village then became enormously commercialized. I went in last autumn, I believe it was, and many of the streets were simply unrecognizable, where they had been small cafes and little jewelry shops and craftsmen and so on and so forth. They were plastic places selling hamburgers and blasting music at the top of their lungs, etc. It simply transformed. But it had already begun to do that in 71, and which is one of the reasons that I left. As a matter of fact, my best friend of my life had left in 1963. He went to Woodstock, New York, art colony up there. And I kept asking, when are you coming back, Loger? And he kept saying, I'm not coming back, but you'll understand soon why, because the place we both loved is moribund, is dead. So, and he was right, but he saw it 7 or 6, 7 years before I did.
And so it wasn't particularly the counterculture, it was this new kind of immigrant culture?
Well, it was, I wouldn't say a new culture, because it became unculturated.
Yeah.
A place that had been, all the time I knew it, for a quarter of a century, and for 75 years before that or longer, had been a place of painters and composers and designers and actors and directors, et cetera, et cetera, became a retreat for essentially pseudo-hippies, and not real ones. So you could find those in Venice, California, or up in Provincetown, Massachusetts, but these were people who were simulating that that subculture and believing that they were part of it. In point of fact, all they were for the most part, silly little children.
Right. Okay, so let's... you were born about 1928 or 26?
27. I just noticed yesterday because of an interview being conducted on television, which I rarely look at, but I did in this instance because it was the subject was Sidney Poitier.
Yes.
And to my surprise, I found out that he and I were born just a couple of months apart in 1927. Yes, 1927.
All right, so you're 20 years younger than Garrett.
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
He died in 97?
93.
Over 93?
Yeah.
And he was, how old at that time, about 85?
86. He was born in 1907.
Oh, is that, then he was 20 years older than I was.
Right. So,
I hadn't realized it when I knew him, but I always thought he was, you know, 10 or 12 years older, but he had a very... a youthful personality, as you well know.
Yes, yes. So, when you met him in the early 50s, did he have his antique store at that point?
Yes. I don't know if my memory serves completely, but it was next door to a theater, and I believe it was next door to the Ziegfeld Theater on 6th Avenue.
That's right, and around where the Warwick Hotel was nearby, right? Isn't that the, like, 52nd, 53rd?
I would have thought it was a little bit higher, but it's certainly in that general area, yeah.
Yeah, is it the Warrior? There's, begins with W. I checked it out. Like, you know where the Hilton is now?
Where the what is?
The New York Hilton.
Oh, no, that's a new hotel to me, even if it's been there for 20 years.
Right.
What was the place you're trying to remember? Was it a hotel?
Well, there's the Warwick. I think it's
the Warwick was fairly within a few blocks of that.
That's right, because when Garrett died, I saw some of his personal effects in envelopes, and there was an approximate address of where his store was, and I went down there in downtown Manhattan, checked it out, and I remember it was near the Warwick. And it may be where the the same block where the Hilton was built in the 60s, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because Garrett,
I'm almost certain that the theater was on the left hand side of his shop.
Yeah.
And the Warwick is up a ways up the block a ways.
Right. And I'm just going to, while we're talking, I'm going to Google that and see. What the exact street is. So now Garrett grew, you know, he was very involved in the theater world from the late 20s, early 30s, and early 40s. Did he talk about that to you?
Not much. Excuse me. He mostly we talked about literature, about theater, but he did not speak much of his own involvement, but more about people he had seen. It's occasionally about music, in which I was interested at the time. I'm serious music, and he didn't indulge in personal reminiscences much, at least not with me, because the age difference might have accounted for some of that, because he was at that juncture had much more experience in among theater people and all that than I had, so it might have been just a matter of a lack of commonality in subject matter.
Right. He always was protective of his past. When he wanted to talk about people in his past, he'd go into almost a theatrical, poetic presentation of them, but any particulars about his biography, he kept that obscure.
No, as a matter of fact, until I saw the tombstone picture that you sent, I had not realized that he had Clinton and his name at all. I thought it was Hugh Garrick Dean.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize that Garrett was apparently something that he simply attached to his name because you have it in quotes.
That's right. It's not
so
his real name.
Garrett was not one of his real names.
That's right. We always thought it was.
I had never known that because basically I knew him as Garrett, of course.
Yes, yes, as I did. So I'm looking at the Google here. It looks like the New York Hilton is on 53rd and Warwick's on 54th.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
Yeah, 54th sounds right. Yeah,
yeah, that's the area. And now, what Garrett used to tell us about the antique store is that he pretended it was a business or he would play games with it. So he would talk about people like Salvador Dali coming and wanting to buy some artifact, and he refused to sell it to him. Or
yes, as a matter of fact, among those few people I knew that also knew Garrett, you have to keep in mind that I knew Garrett in a midtown context, whereas 90% of my acquaintances were lived in the village. But I was aware of the fact and observed it myself on several occasions when someone would come in, browse around a bit, and then say, how much for that? And Garrett would say, oh, that is not for sale. And the person might point out something else, a second item, and he would say, no, I'm afraid that's unavailable as well. So you one always got the idea in the shop that it really wasn't a shop. It was merely Garrett's personal museum.
And a performance place.
Yeah.
Yeah, for his own personality.
Yes, exactly. Well, as you know, it was very distinctive. I've only known two or three people that had the same shading of personality as Garrett had. I suppose you might call that extremely self-contained, self-sufficient. Expression of his personality in those days, it didn't depend upon reflecting or bouncing off somebody else's personality. It was self-contained and complete unto itself.
Yeah, you're saying it did not depend on bouncing off.
Yes.
That's right. So can you recall how, since you were down the village, how did you meet him?
Well, I have no idea how he got there, but there was a rather fabulous, in the older sense of the word, Irishman named Peter Noonan. And he was, I think, probably... a friend of mine once said if he were any more Irish, he couldn't possibly exist at all, except maybe as a leprechaun. And he was an extraordinary man, and he had been a teacher for many years, and he had this extraordinary Irish brogue, and he ran a Saturday night conviviality in a place called Rocky's on 8th Street near Broadway. And I used to drop in quite frequently, and he one evening called me and said, Alice, I have somebody you should meet immediately. And he pointed out this tall, impressive-looking man, and it turned out to be Garrett. And that was the first time I had ever seen him, and I was never quite sure how he eventuated at Petter's place that evening, but he did, and we met and knew each other because he was living, 30 blocks away from the village, and I rarely left it. We didn't see each other as frequently as we might have otherwise, but I would drop up uptown and stop off and see him for a couple of hours on occasion, and once in a while he would come downtown.
Right. So I know that, Garrett always celebrated the village, and he said to me sometime in the early 80s, out of the blue, he said that his favorite poet was Paris Flamand.
Oh, my God.
That's right. And
extremely gratified.
Yes. I mean, he had high standards. And the interesting thing is I knew the name because I was a friend of Mae Brussel.
Oh, my Lord, yes, uh-huh.
And Mae...
How circles do come in upon themselves.
That's right. I remember saying to him, in Paris Flamand, he's a very good JFK researcher. And I had played him a tape of a Mae Brussel show around that time, and I said, Mae Brussel really celebrates Paris Flamand's book on the Kennedy assassination. She has it as one of the top 10 books.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a coincidence between me and Garrett. And
well, that is interesting. Incidentally, spinning off on the Kennedy controversy, I just a few months ago completed a four-volume exposition, 1,850 pages, of the entire history of the assassination and what went before, who was probably involved, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that original book that with which he was familiar years and years later, when somebody said, why don't you expand the book a little, and I agreed to do so. And what I was going to do was that 20 pages or 25 pages of intervening material that had arisen. And, of course, excuse me, as one does, if one is a writer by nature, it expanded into another 1,000 pages.
And, no, I know it well, Paris. I have a copy of the four volumes myself.
You have a copy of it?
Yeah, I got them. I guess you weren't aware of it. I bought them about 2 months ago.
Oh, no, I didn't know that. No.
Oh.
Well, of course, I didn't handle the orders myself. So, no, I did. Well, I'm delighted to hear that you have access to that material.
Yeah, and what's great about it is seeing the pictures of the early researchers. These are people whose books I read, but I never met them, and I didn't know what they looked like. And that's really great what you do there.
I thought it was, you know, the publisher maybe tried to explain why I was not just putting in the dozen or 15 most important ones. And I said, but because historically, they're all important. Even the ones who were wrong are important from the long-range perspective. And so that's why I actually I think they're about... I think there must be 70 photographs altogether.
Yes.
But almost no one who ever did anything of consequence is not represented.
No, it's very good what you've done. It's an excellent encyclopedia of a whole important theme or genre or meme in American culture.
And I hope so.
Yeah, and your inventory of the stages of it and all the people involved is invaluable. And you know, if anybody's listening to this and you're interested, there's definitely something to have. It'll catch you up on a lot of things that you wouldn't get otherwise. You'd have to be searching around and check out this writer, that writer, but it's all organized by Paris.
Well, that one of the main purposes after I realized I was not going to add merely another 75 or 80 pages was that there should be a work where one could... at least apprehend a general picture of the entire period and all of the ramifications and all of the theories and all of the participants, et cetera. And then if they wanted to specialize in the bullet wounds, or they wanted to specialize in the structure of the depository or something like that, they could go on to other things. But a friend of mine... told me, just a matter of fact, about 10 days ago, that when I suggested that perhaps there were various other volumes he might like to examine, and he said, you know, if there are, you have probably already covered it. So
yes.
That's not wholly true. I recommend books like Sylvia Marr's, very, very good work on it, and Jim DiEugenio and Bill Davey have done works that focus in on something to which I was only able to give a page or two or three. They've given, you know, maybe a chapter and a half or something. And there are always new things arising. But essentially, what we knew then, I mean, those of us who were pretty informed on that subject knew then, you know, that it was a conspiracy and that hospitals was probably not even involved, and so on and so forth. It's all there. But
yes.
I don't want to dwell on that. That's not what you called to talk about.
No, but that's an important part of where your life led you, and Garrett's part of your life. So let's go back to, so you meet Garrett in 1953 or so, right? We'd say something like that?
Oh, no, I met him before that. No, that's about the last time I saw him.
No, I said 1953.
Oh, 53, yes, that sounds about right, yeah.
I mean,
I was producing a, actually initiating a cafe, what should I call it, cafe performances under the name of the Symposium, and they were coffeehouse performances, and it hadn't been done before, so it was not easy to get someone to underwrite it. And as a matter of fact, I did it twice in 54, and then I did it again in 59, I believe it was, and 58 maybe. And in the second series, Garrett appeared one afternoon on one of the programs.
He appeared in it?
Yes, I mean, he read some verse.
Fantastic.
Not his own, personally. He read some of Wilde and some of Keats, I think. I'd have to go through endless notes and probably could never find them anyway. But he read something of I believe, those two.
Was he a good reader of poetry?
Relatively. It was not his forte, but because he's was so informed and he so understood the fundamental sense of poetry that it was certainly more than adequate. Most people don't realize that being a disseur, the reader of poetry, unless you're kind of brought into it as very young, is very difficult to acquire the exact balance, because there's a tendency to believe that it's similar to acting. And, of course, it isn't. Acting is portraying somebody as you envision them, you having them speak as you envision they speak, whereas poetry, the whole thing is to withdraw your own personality and concentrate totally on the essence of the poem.
Yes.
And it's very hard for people to do that.
Yes, yeah, no, I understand. So how old were you when you went to the village? 21, 22?
Let's see. I went there. I was 19 when I first arrived.
So that's 46.
Yep, I was in. Yep, around 46.
Yeah, right after the war.
Mm-hmm. Yes, immediately after.
So that. So you become involved in the culture by 1950.
Oh yes, I was very fortunate in that after kind of wandering around. The village in those days was a place where everybody was quite nice to you, but you weren't immediately, you know, accepted. As a matter of fact, it took a good 10 years to be accepted as a village in those days, unless you got in with one of the inside groups. And I did, after about 4 or 5 months, met the poet Loke Reilly. And personality, he ran a place called the Temple Theater, a man called St. Clair Jones, and they were both right in the middle of everything that was happening in the village, and they introduced me to, you know, virtually everyone, excuse me, everyone else that was a mover in that community. And then, as the years went by, you know, one met the more famous people, Cummings and W.H. Auden and Tennessee Williams and so on and so forth, whom one, at least I didn't, you know, become bosom pals or anything like that, but knew them to chat with them for a moment or so on the park bench or stop and have perhaps a quick drink. But they were so many of the startling people of the village, no one has ever heard of. they they were just, it was a unique community. There's never been any place like it, I imagine, and certainly not since its demise. As a matter of fact, I'll just parenthetically note that I just, last year I finished a novel called The Minotaur of Washington Square, in which I describe all of these people. It's a complete Romana Clef. Everybody in it actually existed. Every place actually was that way. And so it was a world apart, a world of its own. And, as they, people have said about people, we shall never see its like again.
Now, this is... part three of a trilogy. Is the are the first two books about the village?
It will be. I think it's fairly unlikely I'll live long enough to finish it all, but I do want to finish the next volume, which is about the village in, from 1950 to perhaps 1965 or something like that. It will go much deeper into the people that were actually responsible for the village being the village, and who one by one perished, and with it, with them, so did the village.
Right. So Garrett would be in that book after
night. Yes, he certainly would. He certainly would.
Is this going to be a fictional presentation of it?
Pardon me?
Is this a fictional presentation of the era?
No, it's, what was the, what did Truman call his book, factual novel or...
Right.
So, you know, in cold blood or something like that. No, it's a book of things, it will be a novel as the one that's already completed is. A book about people as they actually were under their own names, except on the rarer cases where I don't know if some relative might be alive and perhaps the true nature of their uncle or father or sister or brother or something might be a bit much for them. But no, it will be exactly the village, exactly as it was, the cafes and the bars and the parties and the people, and it will be a novelized history, put it that way.
Right, right. So the you talk about Tennessee Williams and W.H. Auden. Did you meet any painters in that period?
Oh, and Franz Klein and Helene and Willem de Kooning and, who are some of the others? John Wood and...
Hans Hoffman.
And Hirsch Margulies was a great friend of mine, although he isn't anywhere near as famous as some of the others, although he's in both the Metropolitan and the Modern Museum here in New York.
What's his name?
De Hirsch Margulies, M-A-R-G-U-L-E-S.
Right. How about Hans Hoffman?
Pardon me?
Hans Hoffman.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I don't know. I know I was at a party or two where he was. I don't know if I ever actually spoke with him. No, I did, but not there, up in Provincetown. He had a place up in Provincetown.
Right.
And I ran into him up there. But you have to understand that it would be extraordinary if somebody from Taos, New Mexico, or San Francisco or something, not San Francisco, but Kansas City, ran into all these people. But in the village, they were there. And so if you were part of the current that was fashionable at that time, it was almost inevitable that you meet people that were famous at the time or later became famous. You have to understand that all these people, de Kooning and Hoffman and Franz Klein and all of them frequented a place called the Cedar Bar on University Place. And so if you drank at the Cedar Bar from time to time, you would meet some of the best-known painters of your time.
Yes.
So there was nothing extraordinary about it or even very special.
Okay, so then here we have Garrett, who was probably part of the village life in the 30s and 40s.
Mm-hmm.
But he's in Midtown. Moved out of the village when you meet him.
Yes, by then he, as I say, he didn't seem to me to spend very much time in the village of those. He seemed to be mostly spent time uptown.
But he knew this Irish guy, and he was a well-connected person in the village history, right?
Well, he had known the village for, you know, a couple of decades.
The Irishman.
But, his shop kept him uptown, and I remember once, matter of fact, walking along 6th Avenue with him, and we stopped to talk to this very strange man, and he explained who he, as we walked away, he explained who he was, and it was Moondog. Are you familiar with
Yes, I know, yeah. Moondog, the guy on the Viking helmet, you know, playing
yes,
on the street
exactly,
corner.
Yes, exactly, yeah. And who was a very strange, but interesting, interesting. But by that point, Garrett was more oriented midtown with his shop and people he still knew in theater and what have you. Although, as I said, he occasionally would be down below 14th Street and frequenting one or the other places. As a matter of fact, it is through Garrett. He once, we were downtown once, and I forgot where we were, but I do know he said, I'm going up to visit a friend. You want to come along? And I said, sir, I have nothing to do this evening. And so I went up to this apartment around 56th Street, I think, in that general area, and very nice, well-appointed place. And he introduced me to a woman named Anitra. And Anitra was, I guess about his age. She was close to certainly 20 years older than I. But how can I put this delicately? She apparently took a fancy. And Garrett noticed this, and he said, I think I'll leave. And I said, yes, let's go. And he said, oh, no, you stay and have another drink. Well, I did, and I left at about 8:30 the next morning.
So Garrett saw that and encouraged it.
You know how he was. He went with whatever he felt was the natural flow of events. I don't think he ever, at least in years I knew him, ever tried to create a situation or uncreate a situation. If whatever was happening was happening, and that was fine, and he simply went along with it. As a matter of fact, he did something like that twice in the years that I knew him. And
you mean two more?
I always thought that he was a person of, I knew he was a person of considerable taste. But I thought of him even more in that light after these incidents.
Is that two more people making three or one more person making two?
Pardon me?
Was that two more affairs you had from Garrett or one more making total of two?
Oh, just one? No, one more.
One more.
Yeah, two altogether.
Okay. Now, what was the name of the
both
second?
Both of them, they always were, in both cases, they were at least 15 years older than I was.
Well, they were of Garrett's generation, in a way.
Yeah. I had a feeling that they were as grateful to him as I was, but for different reasons, you know.
Yes, yes. And do you remember the name of the second one?
I have wondered about that ever since you first got in touch, because I started thinking about Garrett. And I have a feeling that it was Eileen, but I'm not positive.
Right.
Now, it could have been Ellen, you know, Elena, but I think it was Eileen.
All right. You mentioned Moondog. Yes, I think he hung around in Midtown.
Yes, he was always Midtown.
Yeah,
his total circuit was about five blocks, although occasionally he did go beyond, but he was almost invariably somewhere in the 50s.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I knew of Moondog in late 60s, early 70s, but I never associated him with Garrett, and I never brought him up. But that would have been fun
the only time I ever saw them together, you know, at the same time in the same place.
But Garrett knew him. You know, you're saying that
apparently.
He was
familiar. Yeah. Apparently.
Yeah. So, what was the name of the Irish person's home, or the Irish person where you met Garrett?
Oh, Peadar, P-E-A-D-A-R, Noonan, N-U-N-A-N. Taylor Noonan.
Right. So, and he was older and be part of the history of the building.
Oh, he was even older than Garrett. I guess Ted about that time was, maybe 55-ish or something like that.
Right.
I know he had steely gray, wrinkly, curly kind of hair, and was rather amply padded, and he was simply a very large leprechaun.
But the point is that represents someone who respected Garrett and probably knew him for a long time, you know.
I have no idea if he'd known him for a long time. he certainly liked him and respected him, but Pettis' convivialities, as he called them, they were extremely transient. People would come to three or four of these Saturdays in a row, and then one would never see them again.
Right.
There were others that were regulars who, you know, were there for year after year after year. But I have no idea if Garrett simply wandered in on that environment on some occasion and stayed for or returned for three or four, six, 10 visits, or if he had known Peta much earlier on, because Peta had been coming to the village for at least a couple of decades before that time.
Right. So you meet Garrett, and do you want to interact with him right away, and you go to his store within a few days, or you just casually meet him again later?
Yes, I think he invited me at some time fairly shortly. I'm trying to remember if I saw Garrett at Petter's place maybe a second time, and then he invited me up. In any event, it was because of that soiree that he invited up me up to his shop, and I came up. And as a matter of fact, I didn't go up by any sort of appointment. I simply wandered in. A couple of weeks later, and he was the perfect host. As a matter of fact, the first time I ever went there, he had the facilities in the back, and he made tea, and I was so pleased because it wasn't Lipton tea; it was Earl Grey, as I recall, or at least Ki Moon. It was a good drinkable tea, which I like.
Okay, so that first time you met him, do you think you talked long in that evening, and do you remember your impression of his verbosity and elegance?
Well, inevitably, I don't know if it would have been true of somebody else's perspective, but to me, he was very definitely late 19th century. He was, which I appreciated very much because it's a period in literature and history I like, and. We talked, I think, probably for half an hour. We went over to a table, and I have often tried to remember what it was he drank. I know that in those days I drank either scotch or cognac, and which is what I'm drinking now.
Yeah.
But I somehow can't get an image in my mind of Garrett drinking, except perhaps wine. Do you know if he actually did drink or if he eschewed drinking altogether?
No, that's the exact image I have of just him occasionally drinking wine. I don't associate him with any drinking.
Yes, and I think I picture him with wine because it so suits the personality.
Yes.
You know, but I don't know that I ever actually saw him drinking any wine. I don't know.
So the... When did he pick up that you were a writer, or did you tell him you were a writer at that point? Because he often would intuit what someone was and then go into it.
I think he probably assumed it before I mentioned it. In those days, if you met someone in the village, the chances were always pretty great that he was a poet or a writer or a musician or something.
Yeah.
And then, oh yes, I do remember something. Yes, he was there a second time at least. And at that occasion, my friend Loker Raley, who was maybe the best known poet in the village, who was not famous poet, I mean, like Auden or Cummings, but he was very well known in the village, joined us. And if we got, yes, I hadn't even thought of that until this second. We got into speaking about poetry and speaking about Oscar Wilde and Swinburne and what have you. And I recall that mostly we were talking about late 19th century people. And I don't know if any of the 20th century people came up or not. I just, probably Yeats ran over into the 20th century. But that would have made it obvious to Garrett that I wrote, and probably that I was primarily a poet in those days.
Yes. Now, of course, I remember him talking about Wilde a lot. Did he talk about Wilde, quoting him, or just talk about the period? What did you think? Why was he so obsessed with that period? Do you know why?
Well, to begin with, there is a proclivity among people in the arts, you know, to identify themselves with predecessors in the creative fields. And I always thought, because of the way he chose to dress, his general manner, his love of his shop, etc., etc., that he somewhat imagined himself as a reincarnation, but, you know, a replication or a person carrying on the tradition of Oscar.
Yes, because he did mention a couple of times, suggested that he in a previous life had lived in the 19th century in Paris. And
yes.
Would
be it, wouldn't it?
That's right. And I often wonder, did he think he was Oscar Wilde? Because he would have been born just 7 years after Oscar Wilde died.
Yes, yes. I didn't want to put too fine a point on it, but I wouldn't be surprised if he had thought that he, if not a new edition of Wilde, was at least had absorbed some of the personality that left the body and was floating around, and when he came into the world. Yes, I always had the feeling that he strongly identified with Wilde, and more than just an intellectual identification, but a spiritual one as well.
That's right, because, I mean, Garrett could be considered bisexual, but he was mainly gay or homosexual, as I understood it, and he had homosexual lovers.
I couldn't imagine him with a woman.
Really? No, I've seen him with women, but maybe that'd be more.
Oh, I mean, with a woman in the literary sense.
Yeah.
No, I'm sure. Yes, I undoubtedly had women friends because he introduced me to some of them, but I could not imagine him being involved with a woman.
Right. Well, I saw him with many women in Halifax, and he was so sensual. I mean, they.
Oh, he was certainly that.
Yeah,
I agree with that.
And he could seduce. He could probably make a woman have an orgasm if he didn't have to do anything, but he could massage them really effectively. I know that.
That's possible.
But, yeah, he was in some ways he seemed ascetic, you know, sometimes.
Yes, that too, but then so was Oscar. You
That's
know,
right.
It's a curious combination, but not... not unique. Somebody that is a sensualist on one side of his personality is an ascetic on the other.
Yes.
It makes for a very interesting character, but it's certainly not unheard of.
Yeah, I don't mean aesthetic or aesthete. I mean aesthetic. You know.
Yes, I understand
yes.
that.
Yes, that's right. Now, what was I thinking about that? So he would see. I mean, in a sense, he was. I remember when the Advocate came out, the gay newspaper.
Oh yes.
Yeah. He would tell me about. You know, he was quite proud of that. That the gays were doing this, and so he might have considered himself an early soldier for the gay revolution. And he thought
the
Oscar.
Bean.
Yeah.
The
and,
bean.
And that the Oscar Wilde was the early hero of it, and so he was carrying on the tradition even in that way, but he certainly didn't make it an issue. He, you know, he that would be a subtle agenda that Garrett had, it would seem to me. not, he wasn't a theoretical fanatic about it.
Well, I never got the impression that Garrett was promoting anything.
Yes.
You know, not his particular favorite poet or his favorite painter or lifestyle. I found him much more at ease with living than those people who are usually more interested in convincing you that their way is the right way.
That's right. That's what was admirable about Garrett. So the so let's think. I was thinking about the Oscar Wilde theme. So now you're seeing him in a store. Now I noticed in your bibliography you've written a book on healers, right?
The mystic healers, yes.
Yeah, and you've done one on UFOs.
Yes, two.
Yes.
Well, actually, not that's not true. I did one on the Age of Flying Saucers, which is a different phenomenon, really, and then one on UFOs.
Yes, I've had UFO exist for, you know, 25 years, but I didn't know about the mystic healers. Now, UFOs, a little bit, but definitely healing was a big, mystic healers was a big topic in Garrett's life. Did he ever discuss that with you?
We probably did, but I don't remember particularly because it was several years afterwards that I decided to do the book. I was asked to do the book, that period is rather compartmentalized in my mind because I've known a number of psychics and in New York, and several of them were healers. And then, when I was asked to do the book, I went to London and interviewed about a dozen and a half or so of the major healers there, the Spiritualist Society of Great Britain and the College of Psychological Sciences and so on and so forth. And so that all was within a kind of 18-month period or so, and it was after the last time I saw Garrett. So undoubtedly we discussed things that were ephemeral because that was both of our natures. I don't remember particularly discussing healers, although I think it would be surprising if we didn't touch upon them one time or another just because of the nature of our conversations.
That's right. And the healer book was written in the 70s?
Yes. I guess about... I'd have to look at it. The books, there's so many of them now, over a dozen, that it's hard for me to remember just when it, but I think it was probably in 72 or 73, something like that.
Right, because even in Nova Scotia, Garrett introduced me to two psychic people, and I had readings with them. He always was, seemed to me, aware of who the local psychics were, or the good, the better psychics, so he probably knew psychics in New York.
Oh, I imagine so. I know that I studied with a man named Frank Decker at one time, and Decker was extremely well known internationally, but only in his own field.
Yeah.
I mentioned him to Garrett once, and it is 7 years later, and he was familiar with who he was, of course, and he mentioned a couple of people that he knew. I think. I just have a feeling that he knew, may have known Ethel Myers, who was quite well known at that time. I have a feeling he might have met Eileen Garrett, who was even better known. But these are just, it's so easy to have a vague reminiscence of something 20, 30 years later, and for it to really not to be quite true, but it was part of some other conversation with somebody else. So I can't... really confirmed that who it was he knew, but he was certainly interested in the subject and didn't know people in the field.
Yeah, now, Garrett talked about Krishnamurti. He went to a Krishnamurti lecture. Are you familiar with Krishnamurti?
Oh, of course. Everybody was in those days. He was the talk of the country.
That's right. Did you attend any of his lectures in New York?
Yeah, I attended a couple of his lectures, yeah.
And Garrett may have been there.
And what?
And Garrett may have been at those lectures.
It may have been. We never went to one together, but it may have been. I knew a number of people that were involved in what you might call esoteric philosophies and the psychical and the mediumistic, that entire range in those days. And so I wouldn't be at all surprised if he had attended a lecture that I was attending and we just didn't happen to see each other or something like that.